The average price of corn, it has been said, has fallen considerably since the establishment of the bounty. That the average price of corn began to fall somewhat towards the end of the last century, and has continued to do so during the course of the 64 first years of the present, I have already endeavored to show. But this event, supposing it to be as real as I believe it to be, must have happened in spite of the bounty, and cannot possibly have happened in consequence of it. It has happened in France, as well as in England, though in France there was not only no bounty, but till 1764, the exportation of corn was subjected to a general prohibition. This gradual fall in the average price of grain, it is probable, therefore, is ultimately owing neither to the one regulation nor to the other, but to that gradual and insensible rise in the real value of silver, which in the first book of this discourse I have endeavored to show has taken place in the general market of Europe during the course of the present century. It seems to be altogether impossible that the bounty could ever contribute to lower the price of grain. In years of plenty, it has already been observed, the bounty, by occasioning an extraordinary exportation, necessarily keeps up the price of corn in the home market above what it would naturally fall to. To do so was the avowed purpose of the institution. In years of scarcity, though the bounty is frequently suspended, yet the great exportation which it occasions in years of plenty must frequently hinder, more or less, the plenty of one year from relieving the scarcity of another. Both in years of plenty and in years of scarcity, therefore, the bounty necessarily tends to raise the money price of corn somewhat higher than it otherwise would be in the home market. That in the actual state of tillage, the bounty must necessarily have this tendency will not, I apprehend, be disputed by any reasonable person. But it has been thought by many people that it tends to encourage tillage, and that in two different ways. First, by opening a more extensive foreign market to the corn of the farmer, it tends, they imagine, to increase the demand for, and consequently the production of, that commodity. And secondly, by securing to him a better price than he could otherwise expect in the actual state of tillage, it tends, they suppose, to encourage tillage. This double encouragement must, they imagine, in a long period of years, occasion such an increase in the production of corn as may lower its price in the home market much more than the bounty can raise it in the actual state which tillage may at the end of that period happen to be in. I answer that whatever extension of the foreign market can be occasioned by the bounty must in every particular year be altogether at the expense of the home market, as every bushel of corn which is exported by means of the bounty and which would not have been exported without the bounty would have remained in the home market to increase the consumption and to lower the price of that commodity. The corn bounty, it is to be observed, as well as every other bounty upon exportation, imposes two different taxes upon the people. First, the tax which they are obliged to contribute in order to pay the bounty, and secondly, the tax which arises from the advanced price of the commodity in the home market, and which, as the whole body of the people are purchasers of corn, must, in this particular commodity, be paid by the whole body of the people. In this particular commodity, therefore, this second tax is by much the heaviest of the two. Let us suppose that taking one year with another, the bounty of 5 shillings upon the exportation of the quarter of wheat raises the price of that commodity in the home market only 6 pence the bushel, or 4 shillings the quarter, higher than it otherwise would have been in the actual state of the crop. Even upon this very moderate supposition, the great body of the people, over and above contributing the tax which pays the bounty of 5 shillings upon every quarter of wheat exported, must pay another of 4 shillings upon every quarter which they themselves consume. But according to the very well-informed author of the tracts upon the corn trade, the average proportion of the corn exported to that consumed at home is not more than that of 1 to 31. For every 5 shillings, therefore, which they contribute to the payment of the first tax, they must contribute 6 pounds 4 shillings to the payment of the second. So very heavy a tax upon the first necessary of life must either reduce the subsistence of the laboring poor, or it must occasion some augmentation in their pecuniary wages proportionable to that in the pecuniary price of their subsistence. So far as it operates in the one way, it must reduce the ability of the laboring poor to educate and bring up their children, and must so far tend to restrain the population of the country. So far as it operates in the other, it must reduce the ability of the employers of the poor to employ so great a number as they otherwise might do, and must so far tend to restrain the industry of the country. The extraordinary exportation of corn, therefore, occasioned by the bounty, not only in every particular year diminishes the home just as much as it extends the foreign market and consumption, but by restraining the population and industry of the country, its final tendency is to stunt and restrain the gradual extension of the home market, and thereby in the long run rather to diminish than to augment the whole market and consumption of corn. This enhancement of the money price of corn, however, it has been thought, by rendering that commodity more profitable to the farmer, must necessarily encourage its production. I answer that this might be the case if the effect of the bounty was to raise the real price of corn, or to enable the farmer with an equal quantity of it to maintain a greater number of laborers in the same manner, whether liberal, moderate, or scanty, that other laborers are commonly maintained in his neighborhood. But neither the bounty, it is evident, nor any other human institution can have any such effect. It is not the real, but the nominal price of corn, which can in any considerable degree be affected by the bounty. And though the tax which that institution imposes upon the whole body of the people may be very burdensome to those who pay it, it is a very little advantage to those who receive it. The real effect of the bounty is not so much to raise the real value of corn as to degrade the real value of silver, or to make an equal quantity of it exchanged for a smaller quantity, not only of corn, but of all other homemade commodities, for the money price of corn regulates that of all other homemade commodities. It regulates the money price of labor, which must always be such as to enable the laborer to purchase a quantity of corn sufficient to maintain him and his family, either in the liberal, moderate, or scanty manner in which the advancing, stationary, or declining circumstances of the society oblige his employers to maintain him. It regulates the money price of all the other parts of the rude produce of land, which in every period of improvement must bear a certain proportion to that of corn, though this proportion is different in different periods. It regulates, for example, the money price of grass and hay, of butcher's meat, of horses and the maintenance of horses, of land carriage, consequently, or of the greater part of the inland commerce of the country. By regulating the money price of all the other parts of the rude produce of land, it regulates that of the materials of almost all manufactures. By regulating the money price of labor, it regulates that of manufacturing art and industry. By regulating both, it regulates that of the complete manufacture. The money price of labor, and of everything that is the produce either of land or labor, must necessarily either rise or fall in proportion to the money price of corn. Though in consequence of the bounty, therefore, the farmer should be enabled to sell his corn for 4 shillings the bushel instead of 3 and 6 pence, and to pay his landlord a money rent proportionable to this rise in the money price of his produce, yet if in consequence of this rise in the price of corn, 4 shillings will purchase no more homemade goods of any other kind than 3 and 6 pence would have done before, neither the circumstances of the farmer nor those of the landlord will be much mended by this change. The farmer will not be able to cultivate much better, the landlord will not be able to live much better. In the purchase of foreign commodities, this enhancement in the price of corn may give them some little advantage. In that of homemade commodities, it can give them none at all. And almost the whole expense of the farmer, and the far greater part even of that of the landlord, is in homemade commodities. That degradation in the value of silver, which is the effect of the fertility of the mines, and which operates equally or very near equally through the greater part of the commercial world, is a matter of very little consequence to any particular country. The consequent rise of all money prices, though it does not make those who receive them really richer, does not make them really poorer. A service of plate becomes really cheaper, and everything else remains precisely of the same real value as before. But that degradation in the value of silver, which being the effect either of the peculiar situation or of the political institutions of a particular country, takes place only in that country, is a matter of very great consequence, which, far from tending to make anybody really richer, tends to make everybody really poorer. The rise in the money price of all commodities, which is in this case peculiar to that country, tends to discourage more or less every sort of industry which is carried on within it, and to enable foreign nations, by furnishing almost all sorts of goods for a smaller quantity of silver than its own workmen can afford to do, to undersell them, not only in the foreign, but even in the home market. It is the peculiar situation of Spain and Portugal as proprietors of the mines to be the distributors of gold and silver to all the other countries of Europe. Those metals ought naturally, therefore, to be somewhat cheaper in Spain and Portugal than in any other part of Europe. The difference, however, should be no more than the amount of the freight and insurance, and on account of the great value and small bulk of those metals, their freight is no great matter, and their insurance is the same as that of any other goods of equal value. Spain and Portugal, therefore, could suffer very little from their peculiar situation if they did not aggravate its disadvantages by their political institutions. Spain, by taxing, and Portugal, by prohibiting the exportation of gold and silver, load that exportation with the expense of smuggling and raise the value of those metals in other countries so much more above what it is in their own by the whole amount of this expense. When you dam up a stream of water, as soon as the dam is full, as much water must run over the dam head as if there was no dam at all. The prohibition of exportation cannot detain a greater quantity of gold and silver in Spain and Portugal than what they can afford to employ, than what the annual produce of their land and labor will allow them to employ in coin and plate, gilding, and other ornaments of gold and silver. When they have got this quantity, the dam is full, and the whole stream which flows in afterwards must run over. The annual exportation of gold and silver from Spain and Portugal, accordingly, is, by all accounts, notwithstanding these restraints, very near equal to the whole annual importation. As the water, however, must always be deeper behind the dam head than before it, so the quantity of gold and silver which these restraints detain in Spain and Portugal must, in proportion to the annual produce of their land and labor, be greater than what is to be found in other countries. The higher and stronger the dam head, the greater must be the difference in the depth of water behind and before it. The higher the tax, the higher the penalties with which the prohibition is guarded, the more vigilant and severe the police which looks after the execution of the law, the greater must be the difference in the proportion of gold and silver to the annual produce of the land and labor of Spain and Portugal and to that of other countries. It is said accordingly to be very considerable, and that you frequently find there a profusion of plate in houses where there is nothing else which would in other countries be thought suitable or correspondent to this sort of magnificence. The cheapness of gold and silver, or what is the same thing, the dearness of all commodities, which is the necessary effect of this redundancy of the precious metals, discourages both the agriculture and manufactures of Spain and Portugal, and enables foreign nations to supply them with many sorts of rude and with almost all sorts of manufactured produce for a smaller quantity of gold and silver than what they themselves can either raise or make them for at home. The tax and prohibition operate in two different ways. They not only lower very much the value of the precious metals in Spain and Portugal, but by detaining there a certain quantity of those metals which would otherwise flow over other countries, they keep up their value in those other countries somewhat above what it otherwise would be, and thereby give those countries a double advantage in their commerce with Spain and Portugal. Open the floodgates, and there will presently be less water above and more below the dam head, and it will soon come to a level in both places. Remove the tax and the prohibition, and as the quantity of gold and silver will diminish considerably in Spain and Portugal, so it will increase somewhat in other countries, and the value of those metals, their proportion to the annual produce of land and labor, will soon come to a level, or very near to a level, in all. The loss which Spain and Portugal could sustain by this exportation of their gold and silver would be altogether nominal and imaginary. The nominal value of their goods and of the annual produce of their land and labor would fall, and would be expressed or represented by a smaller quantity of silver than before. But their real value would be the same as before, and would be sufficient to maintain, command, and employ the same quantity of labor. As the nominal value of their goods would fall, the real value of what remained of their gold and silver would rise, and a smaller quantity of those metals would answer all the same purposes of commerce and circulation which had employed a greater quantity before. The gold and silver which would go abroad would not go abroad for nothing, but would bring back an equal value of goods of some kind or another. Those goods, too, would not be all matters of mere luxury and expense, to be consumed by idle people who produce nothing in return for their consumption. As the real wealth and revenue of idle people would not be augmented by this extraordinary exportation of gold and silver, so neither would their consumption be much augmented by it. Those goods would probably, the greater part of them, and certainly some part of them, consist in materials, tools, and provisions for the employment and maintenance of industrious people, who would reproduce with a profit the full value of their consumption. A part of the dead stock of the society would thus be turned into active stock and would put into motion a greater quantity of industry than had been employed before. The annual produce of their land and labor would immediately be augmented a little, and in a few years would probably be augmented a great deal, their industry being thus relieved from one of the most oppressive burdens which it at present labors under. The bounty upon the exportation of corn necessarily operates exactly in the same way as this absurd policy of Spain and Portugal. Whatever be the actual state of tillage, it renders our corn somewhat dearer in the home market than it otherwise would be in that state, and somewhat cheaper in the foreign. And as the average money price of corn regulates more or less that of all other commodities, it lowers the value of silver considerably in the one, and tends to raise it a little in the other. It enables foreigners, the Dutch in particular, not only to eat our corn cheaper than they otherwise could do, but sometimes to eat it cheaper than even our own people can do upon the same occasions, as we are assured by an excellent authority, that of Sir Matthew Decker. It hinders our own workmen from furnishing their goods for so small a quantity of silver as they otherwise might do, and enables the Dutch to furnish theirs for a smaller. It tends to render our manufactures somewhat dearer in every market, and theirs somewhat cheaper than they otherwise would be, and consequently to give their industry a double advantage over our own. The bounty, as it raises in the home market not so much the real as the nominal price of our corn, as it augments not the quantity of labor which a certain quantity of corn can maintain and employ, but only the quantity of silver which it will exchange for, it discourages our manufacturers without rendering any considerable service either to our farmers or country gentlemen. It puts indeed a little more money into the pockets of both, and it will perhaps be somewhat difficult to persuade the greater part of them that this is not rendering them a very considerable service. But if this money sinks in its value, in the quantity of labor, provisions, and homemade commodities of all different kinds which it is capable of purchasing, as much as it rises in its quantity, the service will be little more than nominal and imaginary. There is perhaps but one set of men in the whole commonwealth to whom the bounty either was or could be essentially serviceable. These were the corn merchants, the exporters and importers of corn. In years of plenty, the bounty necessarily occasioned a greater exportation than would otherwise have taken place, and by hindering the plenty of one year from relieving the scarcity of another, it occasioned in years of scarcity a greater importation than would otherwise have been necessary. It increased the business of the corn merchant in both, and in years of scarcity it not only enabled him to import a greater quantity, but to sell it for a better price, and consequently with a greater profit than he could otherwise have made if the plenty of one year had not been more or less hindered from relieving the scarcity of another. It is in this set of men, accordingly, that I have observed the greatest zeal for the continuance or renewal of the bounty. Our country gentlemen, when they impose the high duties upon the importation of foreign corn, which in times of moderate plenty amount to a prohibition, and when they established the bounty, seem to have imitated the conduct of our manufacturers. By the one institution they secured to themselves the monopoly of the home market, and by the other they endeavored to prevent that market from ever being overstocked with their commodity. By both, they endeavored to raise its real value in the same manner as our manufacturers had, by the like institutions, raised the real value of many different sorts of manufactured goods. They did not perhaps attend to the great and essential difference which nature has established between corn and almost every other sort of goods. When either by the monopoly of the home market or by a bounty upon exportation you enable our woolen or linen manufacturers to sell their goods for somewhat a better price than they otherwise could get for them, you raise not only the nominal but the real price of those goods. You render them equivalent to a greater quantity of labor and subsistence. You increase not only the nominal but the real profit, the real wealth and revenue of those manufacturers, and you enable them either to live better themselves or to employ a greater quantity of labor in those particular manufactures. You really encourage those manufactures and direct towards them a greater quantity of the industry of the country than what would probably go to them of its own accord. But when by the like institutions you raise the nominal or money price of corn, you do not raise its real value. You do not increase the real wealth, the real revenue either of our farmers or country gentlemen. You do not encourage the growth of corn because you do not enable them to maintain and employ more laborers in raising it. The nature of things has stamped upon corn a real value which cannot be altered by merely altering its money price. No bounty upon exportation, no monopoly of the home market can raise that value. The freest competition cannot lower it. Through the world in general, that value is equal to the quantity of labor which it can maintain, and in every particular place it is equal to the quantity of labor which it can maintain in the way, whether liberal, moderate, or scanty, in which labor is commonly maintained in that place. Woolen or linen cloth are not the regulating commodities by which the real value of all other commodities must be finally measured and determined. Corn is. The real value of every other commodity is finally measured and determined by the proportion which its average money price bears to the average money price of corn. The real value of corn does not vary with those variations in its average money price, which sometimes occur from one century to another. It is the real value of silver which varies with them. Bounties upon the exportation of any homemade commodity are liable first to that general objection which may be made to all the different expedients of the mercantile system, the objection of forcing some part of the industry of the country into a channel less advantageous than that in which it would run of its own accord, and secondly, to the particular objection of forcing it not only into a channel that is less advantageous, but into one that is actually disadvantageous, the trade which cannot be carried on but by means of a bounty being necessarily a losing trade. The bounty upon the exportation of corn is liable to this further objection, that it can in no respect promote the raising of that particular commodity of which it was meant to encourage the production. When our country gentlemen, therefore, demand the establishment of the bounty, though they acted in imitation of our merchants and manufacturers, they did not act with that complete comprehension of their own interest which commonly directs the conduct of those two other orders of people. They loaded the public revenue with a very considerable expense. They imposed a very heavy tax upon the whole body of the people, but they did not, in any sensible degree, increase the real value of their own commodity, and by lowering somewhat the real value of silver, they discouraged, in some degree, the general industry of the country, and instead of advancing, retarded more or less the improvement of their own lands, which necessarily depends upon the general industry of the country. To encourage the production of any commodity, a bounty upon production, one should imagine, would have a more direct operation than one upon exportation. It would, besides, impose only one tax upon the people, that which they must contribute in order to pay the bounty. Instead of raising, it would tend to lower the price of a commodity in the home market, and thereby, instead of imposing a second tax upon the people, it might at least in part repay them for what they had contributed to the first. Bounties upon production, however, have been very rarely granted. The prejudices established by the commercial system have taught us to believe that national wealth arises more immediately from exportation than from production. It has been more favored accordingly as the more immediate means of bringing money into the country. Bounties upon production, it has been said too, have been found by experience more liable to frauds than those upon exportation. How far this is true, I know not. That bounties upon exportation have been abused to many fraudulent purposes is very well known. But it is not the interest of merchants and manufacturers, the great inventors of all these expedients, that the home market should be overstocked with their goods, an event which a bounty upon production might sometimes occasion. A bounty upon exportation, by enabling them to send abroad the surplus part and to keep up the price of what remains in the home market, effectively prevents this. Of all the expedients of the mercantile system accordingly, it is the one of which they are the fondest. I have known the different undertakers of some particular works agree privately among themselves to give a bounty out of their own pockets upon the exportation of a certain proportion of the goods which they dealt in. This expedient succeeded so well that it more than doubled the price of their goods in the home market, notwithstanding a very considerable increase in the produce. The operation of the bounty upon corn must have been wonderfully different if it has lowered the money price of that commodity. Something like a bounty upon production, however, has been granted upon some particular occasions. The tonnage bounties given to the white herring and whale fisheries may perhaps be considered as somewhat of this nature. They tend directly, it may be supposed, to render the goods cheaper in the home market than they otherwise would be. In other respects, their effects, it must be acknowledged, are the same as those of bounties upon exportation. By means of them, a part of the capital of the country is employed in bringing goods to market of which the price does not repay the cost, together with the ordinary profits of stock. But though the tonnage bounties to those fisheries do not contribute to the opulence of the nation, it may perhaps be thought that they contribute to its defense, by augmenting the number of its sailors and shipping. This, it may be alleged, may sometimes be done by means of such bounties at a much smaller expense than by keeping up a great standing navy, if I may use such an expression, in the same way as a standing army. Notwithstanding these favorable allegations, however, the following considerations dispose me to believe that in granting at least one of these bounties, the legislature has been very grossly imposed upon. First, the herring bus bounty seems too large. From the commencement of the winter fishing 1771 to the end of the winter fishing 1781, the tonnage bounty upon the herring bus fishery has been at 30 shillings the ton. During these 11 years, the whole number of barrels caught by the herring bus fishery of Scotland amounted to 378,347. The herrings caught and cured at sea are called sea sticks. In order to render them what are called merchantable herrings, it is necessary to repack them with an additional quantity of salt, and in this case it is reckoned that 3 barrels of sea sticks are usually repacked into 2 barrels of merchantable herrings. The number of barrels of merchantable herrings, therefore, caught during these 11 years will amount only, according to this account, to 252,231 1/3. During these 11 years, the tonnage bounties paid amounted to £155,463.11, or 8 shillings 2 1/4 pence upon every barrel of sea sticks, and to 12 shillings 3 3/4 pence upon every barrel of merchantable herrings. The salt with which these herrings are cured is sometimes Scotch and sometimes foreign salt, both which are delivered free of all excise duty to the fish curers. The excise duty upon Scotch salt is at present 1 shilling 6 pence, that upon foreign salt, 10 shillings the bushel. A barrel of herrings is supposed to require about 1 bushel and 1/4 of a bushel foreign salt. 2 bushels are the supposed average of Scotch salt. If the herrings are entered for exportation, no part of this duty is paid up. If entered for home consumption, whether the herrings were cured with foreign or with Scotch salt, only 1 shilling the barrel is paid up. It was the old Scotch duty upon a bushel of salt, the quantity of which, at a low estimation, had been supposed necessary for curing a barrel of herrings. In Scotland, foreign salt is very little used for any other purpose but the curing of fish. But from the 5th April 1771 to the 5th April 1782, the quantity of foreign salt imported amounted to 936,974 bushels, at £84 the bushel. The quantity of Scotch salt delivered from the works to the fish curers to no more than 168,226, at £56 the bushel only. It would appear, therefore, that it is principally foreign salt that is used in the fisheries. Upon every barrel of herrings exported, there is besides a bounty of 2 shillings 8 pence, and more than 2/3 of the bus-caught herrings are exported. Put all these things together, and you will find that during these 11 years, every barrel of bus-caught herrings cured with Scotch salt when exported has cost government 17 shillings 11 3/4 pence, and when entered for home consumption, 14 shillings 3 3/4 pence, and that every barrel cured with foreign salt when exported has cost government £1 7 5 3/4 pence, and when entered for home consumption, £1 3 9 3/4 pence. The price of a barrel of good merchantable herrings runs from 17 and 18 to 4 and 5 and 20 shillings, about a guinea at an average. Secondly, the bounty to the white herring fishery is a tonnage bounty, and is proportioned to the burden of the ship, not to her diligence or success in the fishery, and it has, I am afraid, been too common for vessels to fit out for the sole purpose of catching not the fish but the bounty. In the year 1759, when the bounty was at 50 shillings the ton, the whole bus fishery of Scotland brought in only 4 barrels of sea sticks. In that year, each barrel of sea sticks cost the government in bounties alone £113 15 shillings, each barrel of merchantable herrings £159 7 shillings 6 pence. Thirdly, the mode of fishing for which this tonnage bounty in the white herring fishery has been given, by buses or decked vessels from 20 to 80 tons burden, seems not so well adapted to the situation of Scotland as to that of Holland, from the practice of which country it appears to have been borrowed. Holland lies at a great distance from the seas to which herrings are known principally to resort, and can therefore carry on that fishery only in deck vessels, which can carry water and provisions sufficient for a voyage to a distant sea. But the Hebrides, or Western Islands, the islands of Shetland and the northern and northwestern coasts of Scotland, the countries in whose neighborhood the herring fishery is principally carried on, are everywhere intersected by arms of the sea, which run up a considerable way into the land, and which in the language of the country are called sea locks. It is to these sea locks that the herrings principally resort during the seasons in which they visit those seas. For the visits of this, and I am assured of many other sorts of fish, are not quite regular and constant. A boat fishery, therefore, seems to be the mode of fishing best adapted to the peculiar situation of Scotland, the fishers carrying the herrings on shore as fast as they are taken to be either cured or consumed fresh. But the great encouragement which a bounty of 30 shillings the ton gives to the buss fishery is necessarily a discouragement to the boat fishery, which, having no such bounty, cannot bring its cured fish to market upon the same terms as the buss fishery. The boat fishery, accordingly, which before the establishment of the buss bounty was very considerable, and is said to have employed a number of seamen not inferior to what the buss fishery employs at present, is now gone almost entirely to decay. Of the former extent, however, of this now ruined and abandoned fishery, I must acknowledge that I cannot pretend to speak with much precision. As no bounty was paid upon the outfit of the boat fishery, no account was taken of it by the officers of the customs or salt duties. Fourthly, in many parts of Scotland, during certain seasons of the year, herrings make no inconsiderable part of the food of the common people. A bounty, which tended to lower their price in the home market, might contribute a good deal to the relief of a great number of our fellow subjects, whose circumstances are by no means affluent. But the herring bus bounty contributes to no such good purpose. It has ruined the boat fishery, which is by far the best adapted for the supply of the home market, and the additional bounty of 2 shillings 8 pence the barrel upon exportation carries the greater part, more than two-thirds, of the produce of the bus fishery abroad. Between 30 and 40 years ago, before the establishment of the bus bounty, 16 shillings the barrel, I've been assured, was the common price of white herrings. Between 10 and 15 years ago, before the boat fishery was entirely ruined, the price is said to have run from 17 to 20 shillings the barrel. For these last 5 years, it has, at an average, been at 25 shillings the barrel. This high price, however, may have been owing to the real scarcity of the herrings upon the coasts of Scotland. I must observe, too, that the cask or barrel which is usually sold with the herrings, and of which the price is included in all the foregoing prices, has, since the commencement of the American War, risen to about double its former price, or from about 3 shillings to about 6 shillings. I must likewise observe that the accounts I have received of the prices of former times have been by no means quite uniform and consistent, and an old man of great accuracy and experience has assured me that more than 50 years ago a guinea was the usual price of a barrel of good merchantable herrings, and this, I imagine, may still be looked upon as the average price. All accounts, however, I think, agree that the price has not been lowered in the home market in consequence of the bus bounty. When the undertakers of fisheries, after such liberal bounties have been bestowed upon them, continue to sell their commodity at the same or even at a higher price than they were accustomed to do before, it might be expected that their profits should be very great, and it is not improbable that those of some individuals may have been so. In general, however, I have every reason to believe they have been quite otherwise. The usual effect of such bounties is to encourage rash undertakers to adventure in a business which they do not understand, and what they lose by their own negligence and ignorance more than compensates all that they can gain by the utmost liberality of government. In 1750, by the same act which first gave the bounty of 30 shillings the ton for the encouragement of the white herring fishery, the 23rd of George II, Chapter 24, a joint stock company was erected with a capital of £500,000, to which the subscribers, over and above all other encouragements, the tonnage bounty just now mentioned, the exportation bounty of 2 shillings 8 pence the barrel, the delivery of both British and foreign salt duty-free, were, during the space of 14 years, for every £100 which they subscribed and paid into the stock of the society, entitled to £3 a year, to be paid by the Receiver General of the Customs in equal half-yearly payments. Besides this great company, the residence of whose governor and directors was to be in London, it was declared lawful to erect different fishing chambers in all the different outports of the kingdom, provided a sum not less than £10,000 was subscribed into the capital of each, to be managed at its own risk and for its own profit and loss. The same annuity and the same encouragements of all kinds were given to the trade of those inferior chambers as to that of the great company. The subscription of the great company was soon filled up, and several different fishing chambers were erected in the different outports of the kingdom. In spite of all these encouragements, almost all those different companies, both great and small, lost either the whole or the greater part of their capitals. Scarce a vestige now remains of any of them, and the white herring fishery is now entirely, or almost entirely, carried on by private adventurers. If any particular manufacture was necessary indeed for the defense of the society, it might not always be prudent to depend upon our neighbors for the supply. And if such manufacture could not otherwise be supported at home, it might not be unreasonable that all the other branches of industry should be taxed in order to support it. The bounties upon the exportation of British-made sailcloth and British-made gunpowder may perhaps both be vindicated upon this principle. But though it can very seldom be reasonable to tax the industry of the great body of the people in order to support that of some particular class of manufacturers, yet in the wantonness of great prosperity, when the public enjoys a greater revenue than it knows well what to do with, to give such bounties to favorite manufacturers may perhaps be as natural as to incur any other idle expense. In public, as well as in private expenses, great wealth may perhaps frequently be admitted as an apology for great folly. But there must surely be something more than ordinary absurdity in continuing such profusion in times of general difficulty and distress. What is called a bounty is sometimes no more than a drawback, and consequently is not liable to the same objections as what is properly a bounty. The bounty, for example, upon refined sugar exported may be considered as a drawback of the duties upon the brown and muscovado sugars from which it is made. The bounty upon wrought silk exported, a drawback of the duties upon raw and thrown silk imported. The bounty upon gunpowder exported, a drawback of the duties upon brimstone and saltpeter imported. In the language of the customs, those allowances only are called drawbacks which are given upon goods exported in the same form in which they are imported. When that form has been so altered by manufacture of any kind as to come under a new denomination, they are called bounties. Premiums given by the public to artists and manufacturers who excel in their particular occupations are not liable to the same objections as bounties. By encouraging extraordinary dexterity and ingenuity, they serve to keep up the emulation of the workmen actually employed in those respective occupations, and are not considerable enough to turn towards any one of them a greater share of the capital of the country than what would go to it of its own accord. Their tendency is not to overturn the natural balance of employments, but to render the work which is done in each as perfect and complete as possible. The expense of premiums, besides, is very trifling, that of bounties very great. The bounty upon corn alone has sometimes cost the public in 1 year more than £300,000. Bounties are sometimes called premiums, as drawbacks are sometimes called bounties. But we must in all cases attend to the nature of the thing without paying any regard to the word. Digression concerning the corn trade and corn laws. I cannot conclude this chapter concerning bounties without observing that the praises which have been bestowed upon the law which establishes the bounty upon the exportation of corn, and upon that system of regulations which is connected with it, are altogether unmerited. A particular examination of the nature of the corn trade, and of the principal British laws which relate to it, will sufficiently demonstrate the truth of this assertion. The great importance of this subject must justify the length of the digression. The trade of the corn merchant is composed of four different branches, which, though they may sometimes be all carried on by the same person, are in their own nature four separate and distinct trades. These are, first, the trade of the inland dealer, secondly, that of the merchant importer for home consumption, thirdly, that of the merchant exporter of home produce for foreign consumption, and fourthly, that of the merchant carrier, or of the importer of corn in order to export it again. 1. The interest of the inland dealer, and that of the great body of the people, how opposite soever they may at first sight appear, are, even in years of the greatest scarcity, exactly the same. It is his interest to raise the price of his corn as high as the real scarcity of the season requires, and it can never be his interest to raise it higher. By raising the price, he discourages the consumption and puts everybody more or less, but particularly the inferior ranks of the people, upon thrift and good management. If, by raising it too high, he discourages the consumption so much that the supply of the season is likely to go beyond the consumption of the season and to last for some time after the next crop begins to come in, he runs the hazard not only of losing a considerable part of his corn by natural causes, but of being obliged to sell what remains of it for much less than what he might have had for it several months before. If, by not raising the price high enough, he discourages the consumption so little that the supply of the season is likely to fall short of the consumption of the season, he not only loses a part of the profit which he might otherwise have made, but he exposes the people to suffer before the end of the season, instead of the hardships of a dearth, the dreadful horrors of a famine. It is the interest of the people that their daily, weekly, and monthly consumption should be proportioned as exactly as possible to the supply of the season. The interest of the inland corn dealer is the same. By supplying them as nearly as he can judge in this proportion, he is likely to sell all his corn for the highest price and with the greatest profit. And his knowledge of the state of the crop and of his daily, weekly, and monthly sales enable him to judge with more or less accuracy how far they really are supplied in this manner. Without intending the interest of the people, he is necessarily led, by a regard to his own interest, to treat them, even in years of scarcity, pretty much in the same manner as the prudent master of a vessel is sometimes obliged to treat his crew. When he foresees that provisions are likely to run short, he puts them upon short allowance. Though from excess of caution he should sometimes do this without any real necessity, yet all the inconveniences which his crew can thereby suffer are inconsiderable in comparison of the danger, misery, and ruin to which they might sometimes be exposed by a less provident conduct. Though from excess of avarice, in the same manner, the inland corn merchant should sometimes raise the price of his corn somewhat higher than the scarcity of the season requires, yet all the inconveniences which the people can suffer from this conduct, which effectually secures them from a famine in the end of the season, are inconsiderable in comparison of what they might have been exposed to by a more liberal way of dealing in the beginning of it. The corn merchant himself is likely to suffer the most by this excess of avarice, not only from the indignation which it generally excites against him, but though he should escape the effects of this indignation from the quantity of corn which it necessarily leaves upon his hands in the end of the season, and which, if the next season happens to prove favorable, he must always sell for a much lower price than he might otherwise have had.